Well, good morning. It's really good to see you again. I haven't seen you since July for the most part. Had a good summer?
Yes.
Pretty much. Me too. If you read your newsletter, you'll see that the fish were biting. So this was a really good summer for me. Well, often I like to read two versions of the same story, a children's version for the sprites and an adult version for the rest of us. Usually these two come from different sources, and sometimes I take some time to explain where they come from. But today, I'm going to be reading, after reading Donald Hall's beautiful little children's book, Oxcart Man, to the kids, I'll now be reading Hall's original poem. He was invited, after writing this poem, it appeared in the New Yorker magazine, to turn it into a children's book, and he obliged with that beautiful story. And here's the original. In October of the year, he counts potatoes, dug from the brown field, counting the seed, counting the seller's portion out, and bags the rest on the cart's floor. He packs wool sheared in April, honey in combs, linen, leather tanned from deer hide, and vinegar in a barrel, hooped by hand at the forge's fire. He walks by his ox's head 10 days to Portsmouth Market and sells potatoes and the bag that carried potatoes, flaxseed, birch brooms, maple sugar, goose feathers, yarn. When the cart is empty, he sells the cart. When the cart is sold, he sells the ox, harness, and yoke, and walks home, his pockets heavy with the year's coin for salt and taxes. And at home by fire's light in the November cold, stitches new harness for next year's ox in the barn, and carves the yoke and saws planks, building the cart again. What a lovely portrait of work well done in a year well spent in healthy, productive labor. Let's return to it soon and work our way in more deeply after we sing. Sing together hymn number 38, Morning Has Broken. You sing that well. That's a nice one to sort of start the new church year with. Well, you might reach sweet 16 and never have been kissed. Maybe you hadn't met the right person, or you weren't even thinking about such things yet. But one thing's for sure, you were starting to think about your driver's license. At least you were back when I was 16. All my friends were. None of them were what you would call car crazy like some kids, but they felt the pull of increased mobility that the car could confer on a licensed driver. We didn't have a shopping mall in our town. The nearest one was closer than the Oxcart Man's 10-day walk to Portsmouth, but still too far to reach on foot unless you planned to camp there and go home next morning. Some kids thought that was a pretty good idea, but parents wouldn't hear of it. I wanted my license, but was not overly eager for it. Shortly after getting hers, you see, my sister had damaged our father's car by dragging the side along a "May I have your order, please?" intercom box at a fast food place. I remember the horrible scraping sound that seemed to go on forever as the white door creased and lost its paint. Then our father died a few months later. Had nothing to do with the car. After a few months of getting fattened up by my Italian grandmother, my uncle and aunt had taken us in, and I dreaded doing damage to their car. My uncle ran a gas station when those still did most auto repairs, and sure, he could fix it, but how would I live it down? Still, he was very encouraging, or you could even say insistent, that I go ahead and complete the process after finishing driver's education. Some of my friends who cared much more about driving had taken two or three tries to pass the test. Maybe because I was less invested in it, I was a little calmer, although my heart was hammering when the examiner, a huge, scary man who I'd been warned about, I better hope you don't get that guy. When he pointed out a couple of minor mistakes I'd made, then he said, "Okay," gave a little pause, "go and get your license." My uncle had driven me over, and now he offered to let me drive us home. I was emotionally and physically exhausted, so he took the wheel instead. "So, what are your plans for the weekend?" he asked. In my altered state of consciousness, I wasn't really sure, so I said, "I don't know, maybe I could borrow the car and go to the mall or something," forgetting that the gas station was open Saturdays and Sundays and that he would need it. He said, "No, that's not what you'll be doing. Starting Saturday, you've got a job." He needed someone to work the drive, pump gas, pull cars into the service bays, pull them out and park them, maybe even drive a customer home and then go get them when their car was done. That person had to be able to drive legally. That person was now me. How could I have said no? My uncle and aunt had been so kind to take me and my sister in when they still had a daughter at home, to add us to their family and care for all of our needs. I wanted to help him with his work, and I quickly grew to enjoy it. And my friends at that time were the high school poets and folk musicians, artists and rebels, all of them from white-collar homes. I knew that there was a certain cool that came with wearing my blue-collared gas station shirt with the name Ron over the pocket. Everyone called me Ron, and I enjoyed this alter ego. When my Craig shirts finally came, I always found reasons not to wear them. I loved being Ron, especially when my friends came in. I also enjoyed the work, even though it paid $1.69 an hour at first. Even when it became full-time over the summer, 10-hour shifts, 6 days a week, 15 hours when someone called in sick and I had to take a night shift, sometimes taking a shift on Sundays. Ever worked a gas station when the wind chill's 75 below or the heat index 120? We had a contract to service cars for the local police, and I enjoyed meeting the cops, some of whom had once had my job working for my uncle. I also enjoyed meeting those on the other side of the law, guys who knew guys, who did all sorts of things. I was offered expensive items at very low prices, but you got to take 50. Keep one, unload the rest, and make some real money for a change, Ronnie. My well-bred suburban friends loved the stories, and I loved telling them. But most of all, I loved the way the work made me feel connected. I'd lived as a white-collar kid myself till I was 15. My dad had been a lawyer. Now, how could I have helped him with work like that? It was the same for my friends, and now I felt that I was the lucky one. I could see how helping my uncle helped the whole household, the economy, and the spirit of our home. We helped keep the police cars moving in pursuit of the outlaws who also bought our gas. Literally, the Chicago Outlaws. It was a motorcycle gang. It all connected. Not quite like it does for the Oxcart man and his family, but better than anything I'd known before. It's a feeling that's hard to come by. That's why the Oxcart man's story both makes me happy and almost brings tears to my eyes. My heart aches with longing at the perfect economy in the life of that family. They care for everything, yet they're attached to nothing except their home and each other. Materials and animals are flowing through the household constantly. Make the goods, take them to market in the cart pulled by the ox, sell them, sell the cart, sell the ox. Walk home and start the process all over again. Everyone contributing, everything coordinated. How could you say no to work like this? But how can you find such work today? I'm sure you all know that some people imagine that people would rather not work at all if they could avoid it. There's a poem from Europe in the 1300s. that imagines a land called Caucania, where no one needs to work. There's poultry, and fish are found pre-cooked and seasoned, and a house has many rooms and halls. Pies and pastries form the walls, made with rich fillings, fish and meat, the tastiest a man could eat. Flower cakes are the shingles all of cloister, chamber, church, and hall. The nails are puddings, rich and fat. Kings and princes might dine on that. And somewhere you might have also heard an American hobo song by Harry McClintock, who went by the handle Haywire Mac. It's about the Big Rock Candy Mountain, that song. But for those of you who are listening carefully, you're probably thinking, they're singing that to children? They caught the lyric, but they didn't get it. The Big Rock Candy Mountain, where you never change your socks, and the little streams of alcohol come trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats to the homeless wandering men. And the railway bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and of whiskey, too. You can paddle all around it in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, the jails are made of tin. Remember those outlaws? Part of the same economy. And you can walk right out again as soon as you walk in. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, saws, nor picks. I'm bound to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the jerk that invented work. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains. Well, I'm surprised that Haywire Mac had nothing to say about taxes, though I guess that hobos wouldn't have had to pay them. Ever seen an I Heart Taxes bumper sticker on the back of a car? You won't see one anytime soon. Nobody loves or even likes them, but you might have noticed that the oxcart man budgets for them in the poem for adults as he walks home, his pockets heavy with the year's coin for salt and taxes. I like that. Salt and taxes. The children's story gives us a pocket knife, needles, and wintergreen candy, which are useful and delightful. But salt and taxes have a mature taste. One connects us back to life's origin in the ocean. And the other connects us with others, with their work and their lives, and keeping up the commons that we share, like roads and bridges and certain pooled resources for help in hard times. Someday all that sawing and walking and stitching will be too much for Mr. and Mrs. Oxcart, and who knows if their children will have survived to help them when they're old. Some people see all taxes as a form of stealing and spend their days on TV or the radio teaching us to see them that way too. That's their work, I guess, serving up a sort of mental fast food. It's always the same sandwich. Love religion, if and only if that means the Jesus religion. Hate taxes and liberals. And love guns. I don't know if that's a hate sandwich or a love one, but I do know that it has many eager consumers. Most seem unaware that Jesus is supposed to have had a soft spot, of all things, for tax collectors. The Apostle Matthew made his living as one. He was a publican, from a Latin word that meant of the people. Publicans were private contractors, small businessmen, who collected money on behalf of the Roman government in occupied Palestine, just as they did back in Italy. Later in Europe, they were known as tax farmers, and they got to keep a percentage of whatever they collected in the name of state or empire. Some were honest, but many were corrupt, often using violence or the threat of violence to enrich themselves. Tax farming was briefly tried in the U.S. under Ulysses S. Grant's administration. Though it proved a dismal failure in the 1870s, a later administration proposed to bring it back again in 2004. I'm surprised that the idea didn't fly, at least on right-wing TV and radio. Think about it. What a perfect way to mix getting rich with Jesus and with guns. Make fast money as an armed Christian tax collector. I can see a hit reality show alongside Dog the Bounty Hunter and Cops. Publican Posse. Featuring shootouts between private collectors and tax resisters, with everyone shielded from prosecution by the spread of stand your ground laws that let you shoot if you feel threatened. And what's more threatening than taxes? What a show that could be. Make taxation popular by making it entertaining. Much better to make it meaningful. Like it is to the oxcart man with his pockets heavy with the year's coin for salt and taxes. We feel that the case for their benefit has been made for him in a clear and sober way, much better than it has been for us. We need to do a better job with this so we can all feel like he does, that this is part of the flow of both economy and life in a world that we share with others. We need to do a much better job. Speaking of jobs, if someday I find that I can't do this work anymore, I hope that I can find work like the oxcart man's. It doesn't sound easy, but it feels complete, completely integrated from day to day, year to year, and person to person. I know, of course, that he's an imaginary figure, but he's a powerful one because there's something about his family's life that feels so possible. So very possible. We may not know anyone quite like his family, but there's also something so familiar about them. Life and work could be like this. Maybe it used to be, at least for some. Maybe it can be so again for all of us in time. How does your work feel to you? That's a good thing to think about on Labor Day weekend in an old union hall. With a day off today and one tomorrow too, I hope. Maybe you'd like to close your eyes to do it, to think about it, but does your work make you feel connected to the earth and its creatures, to life and to other people? Does the work of this community make you feel connected to other communities? I know that not everyone in the Tri-Cities works in Hanford containment and cleanup, but it's a big part of things around here. Trying to make hope from a legacy of fear. Wow. Wow. You should know that I tell anyone who asks that the people who I work and worship with spend their days protecting all of us from dangers worse than tax collectors. That might sound like the thinking of a little kid. I imagine you're all scientists and engineers, but hey, we just had Take Your Minister to Work Day yesterday, and we had one in July, when I learned so much that I'd never known before about what you do and what it means to you. And found myself admiring you and your work much more than I had before. You are more like the oxcart man than you might have thought when you first heard the story. Why? Because his work is holy. There's a religious quality to everything about that industrious working family. Their work must seem so old-fashioned next to yours. But what you do can have that same religious quality. You know what religion means, don't you? Do you? Obligation, bond, reverence. It's most likely from a Latin word, religare, that means to bind, to tie it all together, to make connections or recognize those we couldn't have made ourselves. The lig part of that word, religion, is like what you hear in the word ligament. Not just string or thread for stitching next year's harness, but something that's alive. Those strings and cords in your body that are alive. Thank you for the work you do this year and the next. Work hard, work well, work alive and awake and aware that your work is holy. So may it be.